Hillman. We'll hear argument now in the case of Szabo against Snyder. Mr. Gwick.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Glick, and I'm an assistant attorney general here on behalf of respondent Appellant. The reason for the state's appeal here is because the district court entirely failed to understand the law with respect to procedural default, as well as the state's argument regarding that body of case law. The state had made two arguments below, which the district court really didn't consider at all. The court gave very short shrift to the argument that the court gave short shrift to the state's argument that the ineffective assistance of resentencing counsel claims either were not fairly presented to the Illinois Supreme Court in Szabo 3 on the first post-conviction appeal, and also that the claims were barred under the independent and adequate state law doctrine in Szabo 4, the second post-conviction petition. The district court below merely made a very brief recitation of default in about three sentences that plainly indicated it didn't understand the default argument. It said that the petitioner need not raise its claims to the Supreme Court in all four of its appeals in order to comply with the default laws. And while the court indicated initially that it understood that the petitioner had the prerequisite needed to satisfy default in order for it to reach the merits, it's clear that the court didn't address the lengthy and detailed analysis of the state's argument, and also that it didn't understand the procedural history. On page 4 of the court's memorandum, the court indicates that the Illinois Supreme Court in Szabo 3, again, that's the first post-conviction petition appeal, found that counsel was effective both at trial and at resentencing. In fact, the Illinois Supreme Court made no such finding with respect to resentencing counsel because that argument had never been made to the Illinois Supreme Court. The only two arguments presented to the Illinois Supreme Court in that first post-conviction appeal were a claim of trial counsel's ineffectiveness pertaining to some ARDC complaints and a claim under state law that post-conviction counsel failed to comply with Rule 651C.
Although it was brief, there are several paragraphs in that appellate brief that do indicate that why counsel thinks noncompliance with 651 is important to him. Isn't that correct?
Let me clarify. The only argument that was briefed was that post-conviction counsel failed to comply with 651C, not that resentencing counsel was ineffective.
But why was counsel so worried about noncompliance with 651C?
Well, the reason he was worried was because in his initial post-conviction petition that was filed pro se in the circuit court, he alleged resentencing counsel's ineffectiveness under the Sixth Amendment, but he attached no affidavit in support of that claim. And even after counsel was appointed and even after an evidentiary hearing was held, no affidavits had been submitted. And that's despite the fact that the initial pro se pleading, it purported to be pro se, but if you look at it, and it should be before the court, it's obviously prepared by somebody with some experience in the law. That initial pro se petition contained exhibits and other documentary appendices to the legal claim, but there was nothing to support the claims of ineffective assistance of resentencing counsel, either for failing to call correctional officers or for failing to present evidence pertaining to the drug claim. Now, on appeal, petitioner was represented by counsel from the Office of the State Appellate Defender.
I've got the brief here. The brief, as you say, basically deals with 651, but it also indicates why 651C was important to these folks.
This isn't a pro se brief, Your Honor. This is a counsel brief that specifically dropped the Sixth Amendment issue and pursued a 651C argument. And the reason that counsel did that was because had he raised the Sixth Amendment issue that resentencing counsel was ineffective, that issue would have been found to have been waived under the state's independent and adequate. Well, at that point, it would have been found waived by the state because there was noncompliance with state laws which require that the petitioner submit affidavits in support of his claims in a post-conviction setting. That's why counsel filed a 651C argument in an attempt to get around that, to argue that there was a deficiency with respect to that first representation such that he was entitled to another, basically a rehearing, send it back so that he could that he could attach those affidavits. His claim specifically was not a Sixth Amendment claim. He didn't cite the Sixth Amendment in his argument, nor did he cite Strickland. He claims that he cites Caballero, which in turn cites Strickland, and that there's a couple of phrases in there that indicate reasonable probability and no strategic reason, which tracks Strickland's two-pronged test. But that would have required the court to engage in some sort of mind reading to determine that there was a Sixth Amendment issue. Clearly,
in other words, your view is that reading this argument, beginning on page 13 of the brief, a heads-up justice of the Illinois Supreme Court would not realize that the reason why counsel is arguing that that it ought to be remanded for so 651C could be complied with is so that they could adequately present a Sixth Amendment right to counsel argument with respect to the matter of the mitigating evidence that they feel trial counsel had been on sentencing had been derelict in not providing the court with.
Your Honor, I don't dispute that might be a reason why, but they didn't additionally argue that Sixth Amendment claim. And it's clear from the Illinois Supreme Court's analysis and its opinion in Zabo 3 that it only addressed this claim in context of a state law rule. It's also clear in Zabo 4 when it recounted procedurally the issues raised, that the only issues that it believed had been raised before it in Zabo 3 were ineffective assistance of trial counsel pertaining to the ARDC complaint and also a 651C argument pertaining to the deficiency of post-conviction counsel. They're very different claims. And this court has said repeatedly in Momient L and other cases that in order for a claim to be preserved for review before a federal habeas court, the claim must be issue-specific. Both the case, the operative case law, and the facts must be presented. And that's the error of the district court.
You're talking about Justice Heupel's decision in the Illinois Supreme Court?
In Zabo 4?
In 3.
Zabo 3 analyzed the claim and specifically said that there was compliance with 651C. They didn't address it as a Sixth Amendment issue.
Well, the authoring judge is dead sure as to why they want 651C complied with. I mean, he says here that he wants to do it so they can talk about the fact that the sentencing counsel didn't include the material about the views of the correctional officers.
And I don't dispute that, Your Honor. That might be why they wanted it. That's not the issue they raised. They raised an issue that was a state law issue to get them around the fact that they didn't file their
affidavit. Isn't it a fair reading of this that counsel had taken a look at the record, said, look, I've got a problem here because I don't have affidavits. I don't have the goods in this petition. The reason I don't have the goods is because sentencing counsel dropped the ball. And so did counsel in this post-conviction thing. He never took care of 651. My only hope is to have this remanded to 651C, have that threshold problem taken care of. After it's taken care of, I can raise the ineffective assistance of counsel. And the justices of the Illinois Supreme Court knew what he was about.
The problem, Your Honor, is that the Illinois Supreme Court isn't concerned with habeas as this court is here. We're in a collateral proceeding. In the Illinois Supreme Court, what they were concerned with was exactly what you said. They'll allow them to go back and make change in error that they thought had occurred. But the problem is that for purposes of federal habeas, they didn't also include that Sixth Amendment argument. And that is fatal to the claim here that was presented before the
court. We worry about
court.
Fair presentment. We're worrying about sandbagging a state court judge. How was the Supreme Court of Illinois sandbagged in this case?
The Illinois Supreme
Court... They doggone well knew what was up.
It's sandbagged, Your Honor, because that Sixth Amendment issue was not squarely presented to it. It was presented with a 651C argument. That's the way the defendant briefed it. That's the way the state responded to it. That's the way the Illinois Supreme Court addressed it. We also have another layer of review by the Illinois Supreme Court where they specifically say in Zabo 4, here are the claims that were presented. This other claim, this is a claim regarding state law under 651C. They didn't address it or they didn't refer to it as a Sixth Amendment argument, which was then before them in the second post-conviction proceeding, which they found was bad, which the district court also failed to address.
As a matter of Illinois procedure, would a Sixth Amendment argument have been proper on appeal in Zabo 3?
it would have been proper to make it. It wouldn't have been successful because the affidavits hadn't been attached in the lower court, so there would have been a waiver of that argument. But absolutely, it would have been proper.
Your position is that had a federal Sixth Amendment claim been made before the Supreme Court of Illinois in Szabo III, it would have been proper to make it, but it would have been blocked by a forfeiture in the trial court.
That's correct. That's our argument. And we don't have to make that argument in this court. All we have to look at here is whether it was fairly presented to the Illinois.
We're trying to figure out whether there's an independent and adequate state ground for decision. And your argument, as I understand it, turns out ultimately to be that the independent and adequate state ground for the decision is not the failure to make the argument on appeal in Szabo III. It's the failure properly to present it in the trial court on collateral attack that led to Szabo III. That's the real failure. And then on your view, the reason why an argument was being made based on state law in the Supreme Court of Illinois in Szabo III was that that was a means of avoiding the forfeiture that had already occurred in the trial court.
That's true, but the only thing that I would disagree with is I wouldn't term it an independent and adequate state bar, because what we have here, what we argued, is that's a fair presentment issue. The independent and adequate state bar is what the state court said with respect to the second petition, where the Illinois Supreme Court said, no. We have a rule that we have applied consistently under 122-3 that second petitions are inherently bad unless your case fits within one of these exceptions. And what petitioner attempts to argue before this court and what he attempted to argue below was that basically the exception should swallow the rule and that he should be allowed to proceed with his claim because the Illinois Supreme Court didn't regularly follow the rule. In fact, he knew darn well that the rule was in place. He tried to characterize his second post-conviction petition as an amendment, and the Illinois Supreme Court disabused him of that notion and said, at the time when the circuit court denied relief, we affirmed that denial, and the United States Supreme Court denied certiorari, there was nothing left to amend. You couldn't amend something that wasn't any longer there. He also included in his language in that second petition some words that indicated that there was a fundamental deficiency in the first proceeding. So again, he knew very well that his first proceeding was his only shot, unless he met one of these exceptions. There wasn't some unexpected sandbagging, to use Your Honor's term, in the second post-conviction proceeding. What happened here was the failure of the petitioner in the first instance, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, to present affidavits in support of his claim. And I might add that with respect to the second resentencing claim pertaining to the drug usage, counsel has admitted in petitioner's brief before this court that claim was not fairly presented in the first post-conviction proceeding. Now, the other claim regarding the failure to attach the jail guard affidavits, that information was available to the petitioner better than anyone else. He resided in the same place where those officers were. He was able to attach to his pro se document in that first pleading other exhibits, but he didn't attach these. So that failing that's why there were a layer of arguments that were made before the district court, but it failed to address them because it didn't understand procedural default law. And that's why we're here. Unless there are any questions, I want to briefly address the issue that was raised as an alternative basis by Appellee, and that is that there was a confrontation clause argument that he made that the testimony of five witnesses was presented in resentencing where there was no demonstration by the state that these individuals were not available. Now, we had argued in our brief that initially no COA was sought, and there is some question after the AEDPA. I'm well aware of the court's opinion in Rose Acre that it's not ordinarily necessary, but that predated the AEDPA, so it's possible that they may not even properly have this claim before the court.
I don't understand that problem. What 2253C1 says is that unless a circuit justice or judge issues a certificate of appealability, an appeal may not be taken to the Court of Appeals from, and then it describes. Szabo has not taken an appeal to the Court of Appeals, and therefore, by its own language, 2253C1 just doesn't apply. And
there are other circuits that seem to have interpreted the need for a COA.
Has any circuit held that a prisoner needs certificate of appealability to make an argument in support of his judgment without filing a notice of appeal?
No circuit has squarely held that. There was just
no, the cases you cite all deal with prisoners who filed cross appeals.
Correct.
Well.
And I agree that that isn't exactly on point. I wanted to bring that to the court's attention. If the court reaches the claim as proper, we find that the district, we argue that the district court did properly find that it was procedurally defaulted under an independent and adequate state bar. And even if the court pierces that bar.
I want to be sure I understand what the posture of these of the proceeding was when these five transcripts were used. There are, I take it, three phases. One is guilt of some crime. The other is guilt of a capital crime through the aggravating, finding there's an aggravating circumstance. And the third is the balancing phase. At which phase did this occur?
This occurred during the third phase.
During the third phase. Was there any second phase?
The second phase, Your Honor, this was a double murder, and the defendant was 21 years or older. He was 21 years old at the time. So that's all that was necessary for the second phase. The aggravating factor
Things the prosecutor believes to be true still have to be proved to be true. Now, I have a sense that there was a stipulation to these things in this case. Is that right?
Standing here, I don't recall, Your Honor. I'm sorry, that wasn't an issue that I focused on.
But it may be very important. In Ring against Arizona, the Supreme Court of the United States said that what Illinois deems the Phase B, finding the aggravating circumstance, that the aggravating circumstance is an element of the capital offense. So if these five statements were used at that phase, there's a clear confrontation clause violation, because that's still the guilt phase of the case, as the Supreme Court of the United States used. If, on the other hand, they're used after the end of the guilt phase and during the balancing phase, then you have a good argument, a plausible argument in any event, that the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply. So it's important to know at exactly what phase these were used, before or after the line drawn in Ring.
It's clearly after that point, because this was during the balancing phase where the state presented aggravating evidence, and that's why there isn't a Sixth Amendment problem, because there is no Sixth Amendment application, as this court has said, in a sentencing proceeding.
If we're sure that the only thing on the table was the balancing, we just
Correct.
Have to be sure of that.
Correct. And I think if you look at the record, that will clarify any concerns that you have. In addition, as we argued, any error would be harmless. And petitioner has not rebutted that argument. Unless there are any further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gleick. Mr. Pritchard.
May it please the court. I'm Gary Pritchard on behalf of the petitioner appellee, John Fable. Your Honor, the issue before the There are several procedural default issues here pertaining to the two claims upon which relief were granted by the district court. And frankly, one of them is a sort of, in our view, this kind of typical Byzantine type of very complicated procedural default issue, which pertains to the second post-conviction proceedings. And
the second one dealing with whether Illinois law has been changed retroactively.
Correct.
Yeah, that isn't all right.
And we explained for the reasons set forth in a brief that we've overcome the procedural default hurdles.
But the first one doesn't look Byzantine.
No, and I'd like to address that in our argument. The clear test on fair presentment is where the operative facts presented.
You might want to address this in the terms that I asked Mr. Glick about, because it looked to me like the real default was a default at trial and not in the Supreme Court of Illinois. That was a default at trial because Szabo's post-conviction lawyer didn't do what was necessary to win on a Sixth Amendment case. And then, of course, on appeal in the Supreme Court of Illinois in Szabo 3, counsel tries to bail out of that problem. But the real problem was created in the trial court, and it's there that there may be a problem of forfeiture.
You're correct, Your Honor. I mean, that's where the problem arises in our position, and we set forth in the brief. Illinois is unique. We acknowledge, of course, there's no such thing as a constitutional right to post-conviction counsel. Illinois has set up a procedural mechanism, though, by which a pro se petitioner has an obligation. His obligation is to file a pro se petition. The counsel has suggested it may not have been pro se. It was pro se. It's never been challenged before. That wasn't pro se. But it was a pro se petition. Once he satisfied that obligation, Illinois law allowed him to rely upon his appointed counsel to fulfill his obligations under 651C to among other things, attach affidavits in support of the claim. When post-conviction counsel failed to do that, Illinois law has a procedure that Mr. Szabo was obligated to follow, and that was to do one of two things: either take it up to the Illinois Supreme Court and ask the Illinois Supreme Court, in accordance with its rules, to send the matter back for appointment of counsel who will fulfill his obligations under 651C. The second remedy available to him was to file a second post-conviction petition. He did both of those things. So Mr. Szabo, a pro se petitioner, did what was required under Illinois law to present his claims. He, in the trial court, did his pro se petition that clearly raised the issue. When there was no evidence...
No, that's what I don't understand. He may have done what was necessary under Illinois law to make a claim for a better lawyer, but he doesn't seem to have done what was necessary under Illinois law to make a claim under the Sixth Amendment.
Well, I think...
And since there's no federal entitlement to any lawyer, let alone a better lawyer, that's at least what's troubling me.
What he did and what we suggest was the obligation. It's like a motion to dismiss. He wasn't allowed to introduce his evidence. The procedures under Illinois law available to him, which was his appointed counsel, was supposed to introduce the affidavit. That didn't occur. He went up to the Illinois Supreme Court. He made the claim this case needs to be sent back so we can develop the evidence. He made essentially a proffer to the Illinois Supreme Court. Because, of course, you can't go up there and say, we're entitled to relief on this claim because there's no evidence. I mean, no court, whether Illinois law or federal law, is going to grant relief based upon a pleading. There's got to be evidence. So he, of course, recognized going up there, not because he was trying to avoid procedural default. He recognized, here's the posture of this case. We want to present, litigate our ineffective assistance of counsel claims. In order to do that, we need the evidence. In order to obtain that evidence, here are the procedures we are required to follow. Mr. Szabo did that. He was in the Illinois Supreme Court, and he presented the claim. He alerted the court to the claim, but of course he didn't, and fair presentment doesn't require one to make an argument just a ridiculous argument that we're entitled to relief. He did not need to make that claim. The claim was before the court, clearly was presented in terms Caballero cites Strickland. The two terms track the Strickland standard. You know, this court's decisions make very clear you don't have to say federal constitution, especially Strickland claims. It's been recognized that those are one. I mean, judges, and it was very clearly presented to the Illinois Supreme Court. So that's our response. It wasn't a procedural default. He followed the
procedure. But it was a procedural default. His lawyer dropped the ball in the trial court. Indeed, that was Szabo's own view in the Supreme Court of Illinois. His lawyer had bungled the case in the trial court and thereby not properly presented a Sixth Amendment claim.
And that's correct.
Your client hoped that the Supreme Court would give him another crack. It didn't, as it turned out.
But
then we're back to the point that everybody agrees that his lawyer dropped the ball and did not properly present a Sixth Amendment claim at the trial court in the post-conviction proceeding. And
right.
Now we have to figure out the consequence of that for federal
right.
law.
What happened here was the procedures, again, if this was a different case, it didn't have the unique 651C and the case law that says that where there's a failure to introduce evidence at the trial court in a post-conviction proceeding due to failure to comply with 651C, a petitioner is entitled to go to the court of appeal, whether it's in a capital case, the Illinois Supreme Court, or the appellate court, and ask for a remand. And it's not a matter of grace.
Is your argument that the Supreme Court in Szabo 3 acted in an unprincipled way in not remanding this case?
Well, I mean, frankly, that would be our argument. That issue wasn't raised by the state, and the state's argument on the first post-conviction is fair presentment, and that's what we focused on. That would be our argument. And the state has not argued this precise argument. What it has said is we didn't fairly present the claim. We fairly presented the claim up there. Now, whether the Illinois Supreme Court acted appropriately when it failed to remand it, I mean, our position is clearly it did not act appropriately.
Isn't that essential to your case? In other words, if the Illinois Supreme Court was correct in its determination that there was no need for a remand for further proceedings pursuant to 651C, you're then faced with a forfeiture in the trial court in that first post-conviction remedy.
That's correct. And our position is, first of all, the court didn't, I mean, getting into it, we didn't brief the issue. It wasn't presented, raised as a basis for overturning the district court. We responded to the brief, to the issues that were raised. But our position, if you look beyond the Supreme Court's decision, there were two proceedings. There was the 1979 trial and the 1984 resentencing hearing that were at issue in the post-conviction proceedings. Appointed counsel did do, and this is what the Illinois Supreme Court looked at, an adequate job under 651C to investigate and introduce evidence in support of the one relating out of the trial. The Illinois Supreme Court, frankly, did not even address the issue that was raised to it as to whether it ought to be sent back pertaining to the second claim.
On page 29 of your brief, you do say, this is especially true since the majority of the Supreme Court created this unprecedented rule, notwithstanding the fact that the state itself had abandoned its argument that Mr. Szabo was procedurally barred from proceeding. What are we talking about there? Aren't you, in effect, saying that you believe it was unprincipled?
Well, I'll say what you're citing there was on the second post-conviction proceedings and the issue of whether the first proceedings were fundamentally deficient. In the second proceedings, in order to proceed under the second, that Mr. Szabo had to establish that it was fundamentally deficient, i.e., that there wasn't compliance with 651C. The state conceded that point, or did not challenge that point on appeal. The trial court found that there was a fundamental deficiency. Then, in the Illinois Supreme Court, sua sponte, address the issue of, is the fundamental deficiency exception still available to for a second post-conviction petition? I think we certainly cite the cases in our brief that make very clear that this is a long-standing rule in Illinois that you're entitled to a remand where there hasn't been adequate investigation. And frankly, what the law is in Illinois and has been is that if the record's unclear as to whether there's been adequate representation, you're entitled to a remand. You don't even have the obligation to demonstrate that it was inadequate.
How does the Johnson case fit into all this?
Johnson was, a 1993 case that stands for the proposition that the failure to attach affidavits clearly is a failure to fulfill the obligations under 651C. Johnson was in the same posture as Mr. Szabo's case was, in that it was a first PC and the court sent it back. So Johnson certainly suggests, we would argue that it shows it was inconsistent. To the extent this is an inconsistent procedural default issue, that it's inconsistent procedural default. In Johnson's case, same circumstances. In fact, in Johnson, they sent the matter back on some claims and not on all the claims, just like in Mr. Szabo's case, the same posture. So how it fits in is it certainly demonstrates inconsistent procedural default. If there are no further questions on the procedural default issue, I do want to mention one other matter and just cite in our brief. There's the Howard v. O'Sullivan case that I want to, we cite in our brief that's a similar case where this court, a panel of this court held that there was a failure to fairly present the claim. There the operative facts were not presented to that court. That's a very different situation than this one, where in the brief itself the operative facts were presented. I wanted to turn and respond briefly to a few of the points on the Confrontation Clause issue. The stage of the proceedings was the third stage, but under Illinois law, there had to be a finding of fact. Without that finding of fact in that third phase, I mean, it wasn't simply a balancing and then a judge exercising discretion within a statutory range. Am I going to impose life imprisonment or 30 years, like a sentencing guideline case? Under Illinois law, in order for Mr. Szabo to be subject to the death penalty, the fact finder, here the jury, had to find that affirmatively find that there was no mitigation sufficient to preclude the death penalty. That's a factual finding.
I understand that, but if we agree that these transcripts were used at the balancing phase, after it had been determined that he had committed at least one aggravating circumstance, which multiple murders seems pretty plain, but okay, it had been determined. If I understand the way the Supreme Court analyzed Ring against Arizona, it is that that finding, the capital eligibility finding, is the end of those things that have to be established beyond a reasonable doubt and so on. Everything after that is just sentencing. And it was established long ago the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply at sentencing. So why isn't this outside the scope of the Confrontation Clause?
Because I think Ring does obviously address the eligibility phase in a footnote. There was not,
and it makes it plain that everything after eligibility is completely different, that that's not covered, doesn't have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, it's just sentencing.
It doesn't address the actual issue of do you extend it, because it says as a footnote that this is a very narrow issue that's presented to the court, but certainly the opinion suggests that. However, under Illinois, the statute at issue there did not require, it said the judge, if there's an aggravating factor, must impose a death penalty unless there's mitigation to, I don't have the exact language, but unless there's mitigation, it is a leniency. If the judge finds, or the fact that the judge finds that there's need for leniency because of mitigation, it need not impose a death penalty. The Illinois statute is different. The third phase, the balancing, requires an additional finding beyond simply the aggravating factors exist. It also requires a finding that the mitigation, that there's not adequate mitigation.
I don't see why that matters to the constitutional analysis. Just think about federal sentencing guidelines. You know, all the relevant conduct enhancements that lead people to go to prison for life for selling a handful of crack depend on findings of fact. And yet we say every day that the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply. Hearsay is used in those proceedings all the time.
Certainly
it depends on findings of fact.
Mm-hmm. It has to do with the minimum, it increases, Harris is a relevant case to this discussion too, obviously, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Harris that talks about the difference between increasing a maximum and increasing a minimum, which is a sentencing guideline issue. Here, until there's that affirmative finding that there's not sufficient mitigation to preclude, Mr. Zabo can't be sentenced to death. And so it's our position that is an additional finding of fact.
Just like saying in a guideline case that unless the judge finds that X grams of crack have been distributed, the defendant can't be sentenced to whatever the relevant conduct guideline calls for. It sounds like it's completely parallel.
Are you saying that should be found by a jury?
What I'm saying is under SPECT, which talks about the applicability of Confrontation Clause to proceedings where there's going to be an enhanced sentence, the Confrontation Clause applies. I'm not prepared to take a position on whether basically Ring would need to be extended to the third phase. I think Ring's informative, but it deals with different constitutional issues than the Confrontation Clause. One other point, again, on the certificate of appealability issue is that Appellate Rule Procedure 22 also addresses the issue and says that certificate of appealability is only required when the applicant appeals, and it actually specifically says one is not required where the state appeals.
Do you know whether any other court of appeals has addressed the question whether the AEDPA changes the cross-appeal rule, as the state is arguing here?
I'm not aware of any other cases. I'm not aware of any cases, frankly,
mm-hmm.
One way or the other. I think that's all I have unless Your Honors have any further questions.
It doesn't look like it. Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Anything further, Mr. Black?
I briefly wanted to address, Judge Ripple pointed out that if the Illinois Supreme Court was correct, if there was no need for a remand, then the petitioner was faced with a forfeiture, and that's exactly right. Under 651C, the court addressed its own law and found that this case was distinguishable from the other cases where there was a complete absence of reasonable assistance as is required under that statutory scheme. In addition, here's another error that the district court committed, and my opponents acknowledge just in their argument that there's a recognition that there's no constitutional right to post-conviction counsel, yet the district court, on page 6, I believe it's in a footnote of its opinion, memorandum opinion, indicates that the cause here could be post-conviction counsel's failure to attach these affidavits. It cannot be. McCleskey versus Zant clearly says constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel can constitute cause, but attorney error short of constitutionally ineffective assistance cannot. And so does 2254I indicate that substantively claims of ineffective assistance of collateral review counsel cannot be posited as substantive issues on habeas, nor can they nor arguably should they be allowed to amount to cause. For these reasons, as well as all those set forth in our briefs, the people respectfully request, or the respondents respectfully request, this court to reverse the district court's grant of habeas relief as to the sentence and instead deny relief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pritchard and Mr. Friedman, we want to extend our special thanks to you for taking the appointment and your usual high-quality work in these very difficult cases. So thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.